I've got nothing.
Okay. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Representative Berger and I are switching days in the chair because I have to testify in some other committees tomorrow. We're going to start this morning with the DOR Tax Administration and Compliance Issues. Paul?
Mr. Chair, I think we've, this is about the third session where we've spent a lot of time with Elizabeth Harchenko, the Director of the Department of Revenue, to give you an overview of the department's compliance and enforcement efforts and give you a sense of some background before you start to deal with some of the very particular issues. And we do have a couple of bills for you later this morning that are very detailed, but they're from Department of Revenue. So we thought it would be a good time for you to get an overview from the director.
Thank you. It's good to see you again this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. You have a PowerPoint slide deck, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to visit with the committee, especially to talk about the work that we do under the direction of the legislature. And I wanted to address three primary topics today. First, to describe in a little more detail the work that you have given us to do and how we carry that out. Some of the special projects that we've been working on during this biennium and the results we have to date, and then where we're going in the future. And I would very much appreciate it if you would interrupt me as you have questions. And if you would like me to direct my comments any particular direction, I would very much appreciate having that guidance. And I also, it's going to work. So we administer many, many programs and services, but the big three are the income taxes, the property tax, and the tobacco taxes. And so I'm going to focus most of my comments this morning on those three. My legislative coordinators, who you work with regularly, will address details on others as bills come up, but I really wanted to focus on these big three. I've also, at the end of the slide deck, listed some of the other taxes and services that we perform. Just as a reminder, looking at your general fund, the department is responsible for administering most of the programs that bring in that general fund. Obviously, the largest one is the personal income tax. Second is the corporate tax. Tobacco taxes contribute just a little over $120 million to your general fund, but as we get to discussing it, you'll see the taxes themselves are more in the $400 to $500 million range, many of them dedicated. We do collect a few of the other, most notably the inheritance tax, court fines and assessments, and the amusement device tax. The income tax programs, our work to administer them starts, these are what I call our cradle to grave programs, because we have to begin by informing taxpayers with the instructions that they need in order to be able to comply. We have to help them understand what their obligations are and to understand the tools that they have in order to comply. And the assistance in education takes many forms for us. We have lots and lots of forms and publications. We have a website where we are continuing to develop more applications for taxpayers to be able to serve themselves. We have a small call center and an interactive voice response system to answer taxpayer questions. We have the big building here in Salem, and we also have offices around the state. We're expecting to process about 1.8 million income tax returns this year. As of Friday, we were already past 150,000. We receive during any filing season, in addition to the returns that are due for that season, amended returns and past due returns. We're expecting a little over 60% of the returns to come in electronically this year. Last year we had 20% paper and 20% what we call 2D barcode, which is a paper return, prepared on a computer.
Okay.
And the software prepares a little two-dimensional barcode that we can scan with the laser and get all the data into our system without having to manually enter that information. The processing operation also includes our first step in verifying that the correct amount of tax has been calculated and reported. If there's anything on the face of the return that needs to be fixed, we fix that during processing so that if the taxpayer has added wrong, miscalculated something, perhaps claimed more federal tax deduction than they're entitled to, or didn't match up their exemptions with their exemption credits, we can fix that in processing and correct that. We bank funds in through two media. One, electronic funds transfer. The largest amount of dollars that comes in through electronic funds transfer because of the withholding that comes in from employers. Many of them use electronic funds transfer. We still get many, many, many paper checks, especially in payment of the individual income tax. And so there's still a lot of manual work in the banking process. Our enforcement activities include both auditing and filing enforcement. Auditing, we review returns with a little more detail. Visiting with the taxpayer or inquiring of the taxpayer for records or verification of credits or deductions or income amounts. And filing enforcement, making sure that people who should be filing returns are doing so. We also have a substantial collection function for past due tax debt. And those folks work with people who have reported tax due but were unable to pay it when they reported it, or tax due that arises as a result of filing enforcement. And as of the December forecast for this biennium, 09-11, we expect to bring in about $11.3 million from the income tax programs, which funds about 91% of your general fund.
And I heard million, but of course
I mean
billion.
Billion. I'm sorry. I apologize, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I could easily have misheard it. So.
No, I misstated it. It's early. We have, as we look at the administration of the income tax program, we're always trying to balance between getting people to do what they need to do, when they're supposed to do it, and doing it correctly on their own initiative, and focusing where we do need to on people who are not doing things the way they're supposed to on their own initiative, but doing everything we can to move people from the second category to the first. And we did report last session that compliance by individuals is somewhere between 80 and 85%. We're continuing to look for the next best activity to assure that people are filing and reporting the way that they should be. Any questions on income tax administration?
There will be more later.
Okay. I'll just go.
Another day, probably.
Another day, all right.
Yeah.
So I just alluded to this a bit when I was talking about payments. When we look at our individual income tax, the withholding by employers, so employees accurately informing their employer how much should be withheld from their salaries, and that money then being withheld and remitted, is about, for this last completed fiscal year, was about 73% of the income tax revenues that came into the department. Another 12%, the quarterly estimated payments, people who have income from sources other than wages, are supposed to file and report and pay on a quarterly basis, estimating their liability as a result of that income. That would be, for example, earnings on stock investments or rental income or income from being self-employed. Then we get about 13% of the revenue coming in with returns as people file each year and report what their total liability was and make up the difference between their prepayments and what's due. And our audit and collection activity brings in another about 2%. So you can see that it's important for us to focus on making sure that taxpayers understand what they need to do so that we can keep that maximum amount of voluntary compliance going. About half of the resources that we have for the income tax program are spent on the audit and collection work and the other half on the voluntary compliance work. So I'd like to move to property tax. This is a program that is very, very important at the local level. The state doesn't collect and use property tax, although the Constitution allows that. The department's functions primarily are designed to support and assure consistency and uniformity across the counties for the work that county tax collectors and county tax assessors do in their communities. We're responsible for valuing complex properties. So the utility and transportation valuation appraisal, that portion of the property tax roll is about $18.5 billion of value. It's all communication property, transportation property, energy generation property, so gas and electric, telecommunications, cable, airlines, shipping. That's the sort of property that that we are responsible to value and then report those values on an apportioned basis out to the assessors and tax collectors for the taxes on the property that's located in each county to be determined and the bills to be mailed. We have a similar function.
Representative Berger.
Excuse me, Elizabeth. You said utility, transportation, industrial property valuation is $18.5 billion?
Representative Berger, the utility and transportation alone is $18.5 billion of value.
Of value, and then the industrial property?
Industrial value is 16.1.
18, and the forest land?
I don't have the forest land value because what we do is set the values per acre based on the productivity class, and then that value per acre is used by the assessor to determine the value for tracts.
I guess that what I'm trying to do is figure out what the values are that gets $10 billion in tax, because the $10 billion here is tax.
Well, the $10 billion is the whole property tax system. I'm sorry about that. The $10 billion is the whole property tax system.
Not just your portion.
Not just our piece.
Okay, thank you. You understand why I'm getting the scale all wrong.
I'm sorry. I apologize. So the $10 billion is over 2 years, total property tax collected.
Including through local government.
And distributed at the local level. We certify the values, and the numbers I gave you were values. And then they determine the amount of tax that's due on that property, all of it together with commercial property, residential property, recreational property, produces about $10 billion over 2 years. And then the recipients, again, at the local level, are schools, cities, counties, special districts, and urban renewal districts.
I get it. It was just a scale issue.
I apologize for that.
Do you have a sense of what proportion of the value of the total property in the state that's taxable that you actually are responsible for determining value of, or derivatives like the forest valuation?
I don't have that
and
off the top of my head, so
third,
I'm going to ask for permission to go back and get that number and provide it to staff.
Yeah, again, it's just a scale issue. I don't need to know the percentage points, you know, millage.
I don't have it in my head, and so I would give you a wrong answer.
Right.
So
thank you.
I know Deborah and Ken are taking notes in the back, so we'll get, and would you like that for the forest land also, approximately?
I'm just trying to get scale.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have trouble carrying numbers around in our heads, at least I do, around in my head too.
Some of them stick in my brain, and some of them just leave.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
We will get that data for you. The oversight is, the Constitution actually requires a uniform system of taxation across the state. So the oversight work that we do is to try to assure that the counties are using consistent standards in determining, for example, whether property meets exemption criteria, that they're using appropriate valuation methodology, that the values that they're determining for locally assessed property are within the constitutional and statutory requirements. And that allows taxpayers to be treated consistently no matter where their property is located across the state. We also, in that area of oversight, provide a lot of support to the counties as they have questions about either special purpose properties or struggle maybe a bit with the complexity of some of the special valuation or exemption programs so that they have the resources they need in order to apply the law correctly. Mapping is an area that is foundational to the property tax system. Every property owner that receives a property tax bill is supposed to receive a bill only for the property that they actually own and use. And the foundation for that is the parcel. So our mapping function, we have sort of three big focus areas. One is standards, so that cartographers in the counties as well as our own are following a consistent set of standards in developing the assessor's maps. The second is that for some of the counties, because the resources they have are very small, they can't afford to have a cartographer on staff. And so we contract with 14 of the counties to actually provide their mapping and their mapping update services for them. And then the third piece, which is one that has been going on now for about a decade, is working to transform the mapping system from what used to be on paper to completely digital. The maps have been developed at the county level, and so in some counties we still have difficulty matching on the edges of the counties between County 1 and County 2. So one of the parts of the project, we call it ORMAP, is to get that seamless across county line consistency. The next piece of that is to have the whole thing be digital so that it's available on the web so that property owners as well as the counties can have access to the information and that it's updated and seamless. And the other aspect of it that's really exciting is that because the maps that are prepared for property tax purposes are the most detailed, we have to have the legal description, also whatever improvements have been placed on the property. We have to know the zoning and many other things in order to determine value. That base layer is very, very helpful for other geospatial information system applications to use. And so we share information with other agencies, local, state, federal, as well as private sector. And the overlays include water, emergency services, migration patterns for animals, watershed management, airshed management. There are like 60 different layers, transportation, that can sit on top of those maps. And so we cooperate with other agencies, as I said, in order to try to build that base that can be used by everyone. I think I described the forest land valuation role that we have. There's a statewide classification system based on the productivity of the land for growing trees, and we do a statewide survey and determine the values for those property classifications for the assessors to use as they're assigning value to those tracts, privately owned tracts, for tax purposes. And one of the things I think is important to understand is that the work that we do and the work that the counties do are in partnership, and we connect very, very closely in a lot of ways, but we don't duplicate effort. We support what they do, provide support and advice and oversight for what they do. They take care of everything that has to happen in community. We do the supportive work so that they're better able to focus on those things that must be done at the local level. For the fiscal period that we're in, 2009 to 11, Department of Revenue will spend about $30 million of our budget to provide these services to the counties. The counties spend about $188 million over the course of the biennium to fund the activities that they engage in at the local level, which, as I said, include valuing residential property, commercial property, the land on which industrial property sits, any industrial sites where the value is under $1 million, recreational property, forest land, and so forth. They also issue the tax statements, calculate the rates, and collect and distribute the funds to local government. I know that many of you who've been on this committee in the past are well aware of some of the concerns that are currently revolving around the property tax system, and that is that up until this coming fiscal year, many of the counties received funds from the federal government through the Support Rural Schools appropriation process. Because they have a significant amount of federally owned forest land located within their boundaries, and they are not able to assess property tax against that property. Those dollars are going to be going away. It's not clear. The federal government had done an extension with a step down and an indication that the dollars would no longer continue after federal fiscal 2012. And several counties are heavily dependent on those funds for their general funds. Mm-hmm. We're watching carefully if a county, for some reason, were to say that it didn't have enough resources in order to perform its assessment taxation function. We have an obligation to intervene at least with respect to certain activities. And so we're actively engaged in trying to understand where the risks are with our county partners and be prepared for that. Another area of concern is the senior deferral program. I know you'll be having some conversations about that. It currently is not solvent, and we will not be able to fund the property tax payments that the state has been paying for the eligible seniors and disabled people beyond this fiscal year. This is intended to just illustrate the partnership in terms of funding of core services between the counties and the state. I hadn't realized how much of a joint investment there is in between the property tax and the income tax in providing service to Oregonians. And Jim Buchholz, my property tax administrator, came up with this idea of a way to represent that joint investment between property taxpayers and income taxpayers in service delivery, both at the local and state level. I'm going to move to tobacco. In total, the cigarette tax and the tax on other tobacco products are expected to generate almost $500 million for this biennium. Most of those dollars are dedicated in terms of their purpose to the health plan, smoking cessation, public transit. There's a dedicated portion that goes into city and county general funds, and then a portion that goes into the state general fund. Our administration of the tobacco taxes are a little different than the income tax. For cigarettes, we sell the stamps that are affixed to the tobacco, the cigarette packs, and it sits on the top or the bottom of the pack, and that indicates that the tax has been paid by the first entity that introduces that pack of cigarettes into the state. So we have a wide variety of wholesale and wholesalers and distributors who purchase those stamps and put them on the packs of cigarettes. And then we have, as our part of our enforcement function, an inspection program where we make sure that the cigarettes that are being sold in the state at retail have, in fact, had the tax paid. The other tobacco products tax works very differently, a little more actually like the income tax. Wholesalers report by filing a return and paying tax to the department how much of the other types of tobacco products they introduce into the state. The tax now is based primarily on the weight of the product. And so they calculate that and remit those funds to us. And the audit function really is focused on those returns and making sure that all product that has, in fact, been brought into the state and moved into the retail system has had the tax paid. We also have agreements with almost all of the Oregon Indian tribes for cigarette tax refunds. The tribes have the authority to sell untaxed cigarettes on tribal property to tribal members. That can create an enforcement problem. And so the tribes that sell cigarettes through their own outlets have agreed to sell cigarettes on which the Oregon tax has already been paid. And so we have a refund agreement where we rebate back to them a portion of the tax that is attributable to sales to tribal members. It makes enforcement much simpler for us, and we've had tremendous cooperation from the tribes. The state law allows those agreements and allows them for both cigarette and other tobacco products, and we're currently in discussion with a couple of tribes on a rebate of tax on other tobacco products as well, as they're considering selling those kinds of products through tribal businesses.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the tribe also gets the health improvement impact, doesn't it? If you charge more for cigarettes, we're having fewer eighth graders smoking.
I assume that would be true.
It is true. It has been demonstrated very clearly over time that when you charge more, you have fewer kids smoking. When you have fewer kids smoking, there are fewer adult addicts of tobacco.
And
so the tribes get that benefit, too,
yes,
in addition to the other one.
Yes. Okay. Moving now to the special projects that we had for the biennium. The five big ones were the amnesty. We had a policy option package that enhanced our collection resources. We had committed to reassigning some of our staff to speed up collections. We were given an audit package in February of 2010 to fund the Boost Fund, and then we had another agency accounts program policy option package as well. You've had reports during the interim on the amnesty, and the program itself, all payments that are supposed to be made are currently due by the end of May. We still have a few people on pay plans, but this is the dollars that we have actually banked through December 31st. The collections policy option package included 35 staff positions, and we were going to focus on payroll taxes, filing enforcement, some collection, and taxpayer self-sufficiency, some web applications that allow taxpayers to manage pay plans and know how much they owe so that they can make payments without having to call us. And that, I just got the report yesterday from the Personal Income Tax Administrator. I was looking at this number thinking, is that right? But it is. We've been very, very successful with that policy option package. So we promised $19.3 million. We've already brought in 36.2 with those additional resources. The revenue speed up was we moved about 12 staff off of their work doing primarily filing enforcement and a couple of other tasks to focusing on collections to take advantage of liquidated debt and get it in the door. And we were at 20.3 through December 31. We hit our 20.6 commitment during January. We've reassigned those staff back to their filing enforcement responsibilities because in order to have debt to collect, we need to be sure that we're setting up the billings. The Boost Group, we got a fabulous group of auditors hired by April 1 and trained, and they are definitely on track. Actually, we thought we'd only have about $1.5 million through December 31. Our total commitment for the biennium is 7.5, and I'm pretty comfortable that we're gonna meet that. Other agency accounts, we serve about 284 customers, everybody from the Judicial Department to Oregon Health and Sciences to licensing boards to the Scholarship Commission for debt that's owed to the state. Those agencies have the ability to use us as a service provider. And we had gotten to the point where the number of accounts we had per agent was very, very high, and we weren't able to get to anywhere near all of them. So we were given 13 additional staff with the expectation that we would generate an additional $9 million. And so we're working away on that.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Elizabeth, remind me, if you wouldn't mind, the collections policy option package was just for this biennium?
Oh, Representative Berger, the collections policy option package gave us 35 permanent positions.
Okay.
The commitment to be measured and reported back was for this biennium.
Okay.
But then in discussions in Ways and Means, the governor's recommended budget recommends that those positions remain with the agency and remain funded so that it becomes part of our base.
Okay, and they will continue to be collections personnel?
Yes. Yes.
And do you remember the sort of fare on the collections policy option package?
Okay. The cost of the package on the spending side was $5.1 million total funds. About 4.6 of that was general fund and about $500,000 of other funds.
Excuse me, if I could pursue.
Yeah.
And this will be an ongoing sort of budget carve-out, continuing other biennium out into the future, how are we going to manage this going forward in terms of judging whether these 35 are producing? Do you understand the question?
Yes. Yes, I do, Representative Berger.
Or 32, however.
What has happened over the course of the biennia, as we've been given additional staff, is that the initial investment, because it's augmenting our ability to produce, Ways and Means has asked for a commitment of what the revenue generation would be and for that to be tracked for the biennium and reported back during budget hearings. So we'll be reporting back in March on the performance of the package. From that point forward, if the positions were given to us as permanent positions, they're folded into the family, and our base level of revenue generation is sort of permanently enhanced by that. We have a key performance measure that's related to production per staff member, per revenue agent. And in addition to adding people, which allows us to generate additional revenue, we're also looking for ways to improve the productivity of each employee that we have doing that kind of work. So this was a pretty diversified package. We had, in addition to revenue agents, we had a couple of policy analysts and operational analyst type positions to focus on how do we make ourselves more productive per person.
In collections,
so that we're not needing to come back and say the only way that we can enhance our effectiveness for you is by adding people, that we're really looking to make the people that we have as effective as possible.
Yeah, please.
One other quick question. Remind us about Boost.
Okay.
It's just, yeah.
Yes, Boost was in the February session, 2010. I'm going to mess up the acronym, but I think it was business opportunity.
That's okay.
I can't remember. Anyway, the focus was to...
It illustrates why I hate acronyms.
The focus was to fund a small fund within Business Oregon that could be used for grants and loans to small business in order to accelerate hiring. And so the we have our partner is Business Oregon, and so the idea was that we would focus on the audit side as opposed to collections, focus on the audit side, and that the revenues that came in from the audit work that was done by this group would go into this special little boost pot that would then be made available to Business Oregon for loans and grants. So we've already transferred to them $3.3 million of the $7.5 million that was committed to. The auditors were funded by some of the excess revenues that were coming in from amnesty. So okay. You may remember that the part of the amnesty revenues were used to fund that group of that audit team. And in the upcoming budget, the governor's recommending that we keep those auditors, that they become general fund staff, and that all the revenue that they generate then goes into the general fund. The boost fund itself was limited to this biennium.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And also, I think there's a pour-over in the statute that if we generate more than $7.5 million, anything more than that doesn't go into that fund. It pours over into the general fund.
While we're on this topic, I wanted to make sure the committee understands the way in which the department's efficiencies work, just briefly. And it seems, and so you understand the question, it seems to me that the lowest cost tax collection for you is a collection from a taxpayer who files a return in the normal course and pays the tax on time. That's very, yeah, very low cost to you. I mean, it's basically a bookkeeping function.
Right.
And most of that's automated at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we'll talk about that with the bill we have coming up next. You spend quite a bit more when you have to go find people to file tax returns, and then when you have to go find them again to actually pay the tax.
Correct.
That costs a lot more money. But even then, the net to the general fund is very substantial. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement, Representative Barnhart.
Net after paying your costs.
Correct.
And, of course, for me, that was an insight in the last couple of years, which is why I pushed hard to get some of these augmentations done, mm-hmm, because it seemed to me. Now, there's one other point, too, and that is that if you take somebody who's not filing a tax return and get them to file a tax return, you increase the odds of them filing again next year, don't you?
If we make it a pleasant experience.
Or at least one that they understand they're going to have to do.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
No one's particularly excited positively about paying taxes, but most of us do, and one of the motives for that is that it's required, and potentially unpleasant things happen if you don't. But so funds that you spend now on collections, at least in theory, ought to increase collections on that lower cost level later.
Representative Barnhart, I think there are many contributors to voluntary compliance. We have, just from interacting with taxpayers, we hear that some are motivated by the fact that they know they're contributing to public services that they value. Some are motivated by this is an obligation of being a citizen, and you know I might spend the money differently, but I'll fulfill my obligation as a citizen. Some need prompting, and it may be that this is a difficult income tax compliance, particularly, is not an easy thing to do.
No,
you have to, in order to do it for Oregon, you have to fill out your federal form, then you have to go to the Oregon form, and calculate your liability and remit it. If you are a wage earner, it's a little easier to do the remitting, obviously, because that's a process that's automatic. There are lots of reasons why people, even who report but don't pay, don't do that. And so we have to be sure that we're bringing in the delinquent tax debt. And we also have to make sure that people understand that if they haven't filed and should be filing, that we're likely to find them, And we have many, many tools to encourage them to satisfy their statutory obligation. And as I said earlier, we're trying to move people one of my former deputies had a picture on her board, triangle, upside down triangle. And the top was, I can, I will, I do. The middle was, I want to, but I need some help. And the bottom was, not going to do it. And we got to move people from the lower part of the triangle to the middle and the middle to the top by giving them more tools so it becomes less of a burden and it's easier because more of the calculation and the difficult parts automated, and then we provide appropriate support. When we look at our total cost of the income tax programs, you invest a dollar and we return 100. When we look at enforcement, that's where it's more people intensive, but you're still getting quite a return for the dollars that you're spending on our enforcement efforts. And as I said, we're doing everything we can to make sure that for each person who is doing that kind of work, they have the resources that they need to be very, very effective.
Thank you.
The other project that we had that didn't have a revenue promise with it was the pilot on determining whether having income tax compliance be a condition of receiving a license renewal. The interim committee had progress reports on that, and we just sent an electronic final report to all members. Our conclusion is that we ought to continue the work. We work with three agencies. We'd like to try three different agencies. We'd like to learn more about some people were motivated sufficiently just by getting information about their obligation and some assistance brought themselves into compliance. So we want to learn just a little bit more about the behavior of people before coming back with a recommendation on whether you ought to broadly require tax compliance before the issuance or renewal of a license.
Can I pursue this one more thing?
Yeah.
Elizabeth, can you pop back to the personal income tax revenue pie chart? That one. Didn't you say when you were talking about that half of your resources, I think you said, is spent on audits and collections and half on half on the rest?
When we look at the whole budget of resources we spend for income tax administration, about half of those dollars are used to administer the voluntary part of the system, which is the forms, publications, assistance,
everything but the 2%.
Everything but the audit, filing, enforcement, and collection function.
And so the other half is on that
2%.
It's sort of 98-2,
right,
rather than 80-20 rule. I just wanted that pointed out.
Right.
Okay.
And as Representative Barnhart pointed out, it's still the return that you get for the investment in that staff is still multiples of one. It's not 100-1, but it's still multiples of one.
It looked like about 15 or so, given from the other chart. But maybe it's even better than that.
Well, I don't think it's 15. I think it's...
I mean, 15 out of 100. $15 cost for $100 of return.
Yeah.
Now, I made that up based on the numbers you were giving us.
Well, let us go back and make sure that we've got that.
And I don't need to know
calculated
that
correctly. But
yeah.
But the point, one of the things that's important, and you made the point, Representative Barnhart, is that as people are aware that this work goes on, mm-hmm, that we are pursuing filing, that we are pursuing correct filing, and that people have the information to validate the information they put on their returns, that has an impact on people's self-initiated behavior. So some of the correctness of what's going on out there is because people do believe that we will discover them and pursue them.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to, as a tax practitioner, agree with you wholeheartedly that even though the overall collection is only 2%, that is the cost of that is really pennies on the dollar for really encouraging a voluntary compliance of tax filings. The other point I wanted to make, too, is from an audit perspective, we really benefit to the The more that we connect to the federal government, we let the federal agents go after the major part of the auditing, and then we just kind of piggyback on assessment from that through the disclosure. And so that audit and collections part is very important, and the reconnect is also saves us money, I think. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. There we go. Come on. Okay. So I wanted to spend a little time with where we're going. I've talked about what we do. I've talked about some of our special projects. I want to talk to you about the work we've been doing in the agency on transformation. We have undertaken in the agency, this was started because we recognized that we were going to need to replace our computer systems at some point. And the computer systems right now are a patchwork of many big systems that were built at different times and on platforms that are a little hard to work with. And so we know that we need to change that.
Hard to find those vacuum tubes now.
Well, yeah, I think we're past the vacuum tubes, but it's still very much, we're not on a mainframe, but it's still a kind of a rigid kind of crotchety system, and it's not easy for it to connect to web-enabled services internally or externally. So we started thinking about we don't want to just replace those systems with other systems that do the same thing. We need to really think about how we do what we do, how we carry out the business that you've given us to do, and we've started by focusing on our business processes so that when it's time for us to describe and contract for services to be replaced with the computer systems, we're doing it for an efficient set of business processes. So over the course of the last 6 or 8 months, we've talked a lot about how do we focus, especially in this economic situation, how do we focus so that the work that we're doing is the best possible work with the resources that we have. So we took our mission, which is to make revenue systems work to fund the services that preserve and enhance the quality of life for all citizens, and sort of condense that down to our business purpose really is healthy revenue systems. And just as we were talking about, the more people who do what they're supposed to do when they're supposed to do it with support and very little prompting, the better, that's really a healthy system. So if people trust that the system is working for them, that they get timely information, timely refunds, timely feedback, and we make it as simple as is possible, those systems are more likely to be healthy. We set for ourselves three very high-level targets of perfection. In a perfect world, a healthy revenue system would be one where 100%, you have 100% compliance by people doing things what they're supposed to be doing when they're supposed to be doing them, that 100% accuracy both in the work we do and what we receive from taxpayers. And we also set a target for ourselves to double the value that we provide, either through creating greater efficiency or more productivity. And we've written this way so that it's transferable across all the programs that we have, and we call this our True North. If you sat through a presentation that I did two years ago or so, I talked about seven goal areas. We've concentrated those seven goal areas into four primary strategy areas: compliance, making it easier to comply, intervening as soon as we determine that someone hasn't complied, and doing the best job we can to verify accuracy. Customer satisfaction or taxpayer service, providing the right services on a timely basis for people. The effectiveness of our workforce, making sure people have the tools they need to do the work they have to do so they can be as effective and efficient as possible. And leveraging partnerships. We have many, many partnerships that we engage in today. I talked about the counties. Representative Eric Brewer mentioned the partnership we have with the Internal Revenue Service. We have many, many partnerships, and we need to continue to leverage those so that we're as effective as we can be and our partners are as effective as they can be. we have developed for each of these big strategy blocks, because the way that those are expressed right now is relatively timeless, some strategic objectives and operational objectives that help bring our focus down to concrete activity that we will engage in over the next 6 to 18 months. And we are just beginning the process now of engaging our staff in identifying the specific projects that we can do to help us achieve our strategic objectives. So let me just give you one example, because I'm sensitive to the time we have left. For compliance, we set a strategic objective for ourselves to provide accurate and timely customer interactions at the lowest cost. The operational objective that we've developed there is to provide taxpayers more opportunities to be self-sufficient in obtaining information and resolving their accounts. And so what we will now do is say to staff, okay, if what we want to do is provide taxpayers more chances to do what they need to do in a self-sustaining way, to get information that they need, resolve their accounts on their own initiative, what kinds of activities could we engage in order to further that objective? And staff will make a lot of suggestions. We've had some already. And we will identify a project, put a project team together, establish measures, outcomes that we want, and we will focus that project so that we're achieving the operational objective. And the idea is that this all cascades down to a point at which everyone in the organization knows how what they're doing is helping us achieve one or more of our strategic objectives and how they contribute on a daily basis to healthy revenue systems. So it's a way of thinking about really integrating within the organization the resources that we have, the intellectual capital that we have, the energy and creativity that we have in our staff to really move in a direction. It helps us with decision making. And one thing that I will tell you is that as you are going through your decision making, particularly about program changes or tools or any other direction that you want to give to us, we would ask that you also consider our true north. We're trying to move away from scattershot, well, will this work, will that work, and look for the very next best thing that we can do, whether it's the next best audit to initiate, the next best account to begin to collect, or the next best tool to develop. We're trying to really be much more rigorous about using information to evaluate potential and always tying back and asking ourselves the question, if we do this, will it help us get to greater voluntary compliance, greater accuracy, greater value or efficiency for the work that we're doing? Will it help us with our strategies? Will it help us achieve True North? So I wanted to leave you with that, and I'm happy to answer any questions. The last slide deck, or slide in the deck, as I told you, is some of the other taxes and programs that we administer. I very much appreciate the time, and I'm happy to come back if you need to move on to bills.
Well, Representative Air Brewer.
Thank you. I was just accumulating a couple questions as you were going through the your presentation. I noticed for estimated taxes and return payments, it looked like, gosh, where did I come up with the math? About 12%, you gave a figure, oh gosh, I'm going backwards now, but it looks like of the $11.3 billion, about $2.6 billion is collected through estimated taxes and return payments, based on some of the numbers you gave me as I calculated through when you were doing it. What I wanted to know, okay, here we go, what's 13 and 12% each of the $11.3 billion. So if I'm correct on that, how much of that $2.6 billion is electronically transmitted, and is there an opportunity for efficiencies by increasing that number?
Representative Air Brewer, we are working on increasing use of electronic funds transfer with corporations that have to file quarterly estimated, making that available. The Internal Revenue Service is steadily increasing the size of the population of employers who are supposed to use electronic funds transfer for payroll taxes, and we are piggybacked on that schedule so that larger and larger numbers of businesses that have employees are using electronic funds transfer. Return payments are pretty much coming in as checks. And since it's a one-time payment, I think it's unlikely that individual taxpayers are going to be willing to set up an EFT account simply to make one payment. We are making electronic refund payments, direct deposit refund payments, at the request of taxpayers if they give us routing number for their checking accounts. And so we are looking for every opportunity that we can to use electronic funds transfer rather than paper checks, because paper checks are take time to process. There's also something called, it's some sort of digital check, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but we're exploring whether we can use it at least for processing the checks with the banks instead of having to move the paper documents. It's
nine.
Yeah, I can't remember. Check 10 or something like that.
21, I think.
Check 21, yes. So
a scanning system.
Yeah.
Check comes in, you scan it, the bank pays it.
So we're looking for every opportunity to use technology to make that payment process more efficient.
Thank you. My other question, if I might.
Please, yes.
Is this is kind of a best practice question. This has to do more with property tax and the administration of it. Are other states set up like our state is set up, where the Department of Revenue provides this oversight to the counties for the valuation certification, the assessment and collection? Are we set up similar to other states, or is there an opportunity to remove a layer of management in this?
Well, I'll tell you, Representative Airbrewer, my knowledge is stronger about in the Northwest because of the states that we work with most closely. Montana actually administers their whole property tax system at the state level. They do have local officials who do work in community, because there's some work that has to be done at the local level, but they actually administer the whole property tax system. That's a very small minority. I think most states have some division between the work that's done at the state level and the work that's done at the local level. It might look different across the states for mapping. Most states, at least the utility valuation, is done centrally, simply because many of those businesses, the properties, are used in multiple counties, and it's very, very difficult for a county assessor to try to determine the appropriate value of, say, airline property or railroad property that's in the county. Other states, I think, may or may not do the industrial. Ours has a history to it. I'd be happy to review it with you individually if you'd like a little bit more history on how the property tax system has grown in Oregon. And we're in touch with our sister states, particularly Idaho, Washington, Montana, on issues related to valuation of personal property and some of the other things that are specific to the property tax system. There is some variability, but I would say most states do the utility at the state level. Many provide some support and supervision. I don't know whether all states have a uniformity provision similar to ours in the Constitution. California has a very robust industrial as well as utility valuation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much. We very much value your... Sorry. Representative Dance.
Thank you. Just a very short question on the pie chart that showed the amount of tax and where we obtain it. I didn't see a state tax. Can you give us the...
Oh, it's in the other. It's in the other, and the inheritance tax was... Oh, I had it written down because I thought I would get the question.
About 200?
It varies pretty significantly from biennium to biennium.
Well, of course, we make an estimate, and then it depends on who dies.
Right, and how much they pass in a taxable estate. But it's in the other chunk, and I know that your staff does a full report on sources of the dollars. I didn't want to try to repeat that because I wouldn't do as good a job.
committee, we do have a briefing on the inheritance tax on Thursday, and then followed by the Law Commission's proposal or introduction to those. So we'll go through the latest on that on Thursday.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Anything
else? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I suspect we'll see you some more.
I'm be very grateful to be able to come and see you again.
And with that, we'll close the information meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2071. Is that Chris? Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2071 comes from the Department of Revenue, and it would grant rulemaking authority to the Department of Revenue to require paid tax preparers and corporations to file electronic returns if they are required to do so at the federal level. It would allow the department to establish exceptions to those rules and would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2011.
Great. And do we have the department wants to be heard, I assume. I don't know if we have a sign-up sheet for this bill.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And with me is a gentleman who's going to partner with me during this session and hopefully eventually replace me at the end of the session, Ken Ross, and he's jumping in with the first bill today.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart. Ken Ross with the Department of Revenue, as Deborah said. Just a couple brief notes on this House bill. This, like Chris said, this allows us to require filing returns electronically if so required at the federal level. And those federal mandates right now stand for personal income tax at 100. A preparer that anticipates filing 100 or more returns, they have to file them electronically. That's for basically for the 2012 filing season. The following year, the threshold drops to 10 or more returns. For corporations, there's already a mandate in place. It's been in place since 2008 that requires a corporation to file electronically if they have 250 or more returns. They're calling returns, which could include 1099s and W-2s. We're putting this forward, so obviously to sync us up with the IRS, there's obvious benefits in filing electronically. There are lower error rates. There are reduced costs to process and store returns. It also gives us the ability to capture and access information more efficiently. We have talked with some stakeholders that would be affected by this, software vendors there on board, and they typically have more incentive if there's a mandate, if there's a law that says they have to do it. Obviously, they're more inclined to do it, but they would be on board with this. We have talked to the tax practitioner communities, those that report to the Board of Tax Practitioners, and also OSCPA, and they're on board with it. And like Chris said, this gives us rule writing authority, so we would could write the mandate in. We would also have an exception in the rule for hardship or undue burden, whatever the case might be.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the cost of, if the concept is to drive vendors, is that the underlying concept here, to prompt the vendors of the prepare the device? Is that the idea?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Mintz, and I would say no, that the underlying concept here is not to drive the software vendors, but is to get tax practitioners on board with filing electronically.
Please, yes.
The cost, thank you, Mr. Chair, the cost then is what? If they have to, the practitioners our CPA should be asking this question because I don't know what software is used, but they would have to buy it or figure out how to file electronically if they didn't have it. That's my guess. So I'm just trying to figure, out what the new cost is for the private practitioner and thus the taxpayer if we push this direction.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Vance, we're all looking over here at Representative Eric Brewer.
Do you want to take that one?
I might. Thank you. I might chime in a bit. If they're already federally required to electronically file, for the most part they're set up. There may be an increased software cost if the software vendor increases rates as a result. Oregon is usually a very forgotten state in filing. We're usually one of the last to get updates and such because in population we're not that much. Once they have an electronic filing set up, it truly, we use the software ready to prepare the returns. Now it's just a matter of pressing a button to send it rather than pressing a button to print it. So there may be an increased software vendor charge, though, depending on what they pass through.
Yes, please.
And if I may, how much might that be?
Do we have an idea what the cost is for that kind of thing?
Free market. I don't know.
Yeah. Representative Benz, did you have other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to figure out if we were already doing this by virtue of most folks filing federally electronically, then why are we doing it? If indeed this is going to prompt some activity, it seemed to me that the reference to the software was the key, and that brought me to the cost issue. So I'd sure like to know the cost. That's my point. If it's insignificant, great. If it isn't, need to know.
Representative Vance, we'll find the cost.
Thank you.
Get that to you.
Yeah, that was really one of my questions. I don't prepare tax returns, even my own. So there are several steps on this sheet that I simply don't understand very well. I'd like to ask a couple of questions about that. I'm looking at the two bullet points, or the three bullet points at the top of the page of the handout that you've given us. Preparers who anticipate filing 100 or more returns this year, or 11 or more returns next year, what does the word filing mean in that context? We're talking about returns that the practitioner files or prepares, because those are very different things.
Chair Barnhart.
Just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, my tax return is prepared by an accountant, but I file it.
Chair Barnhart, my understanding is that if they prepare 100 returns or more, they would be required to file them electronically.
So we mean, instead of the word filing, we really mean prepare in those two bullets.
Correct.
Okay. All right, that would pretty much include every preparer, wouldn't it? I suppose there are a few who prepare fewer than 11 returns, but can't imagine that anybody makes much of a living doing that, except maybe an accountant working for a very large corporation who prepares only one return or two.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could answer that. I've talked with a few practitioners who, after they retire, continue to have a few clients that want them to stay on because they're so familiar with their situations. So in that case, those would probably
right.
not be required.
And again, this is simply my ignorance. Describe to us how you validate a return that is sent to you electronically. I mean, you validate my return because I sign it and mail it to you. How do you validate returns that are sent electronically to you?
Chair Barnhart, all the current process for electronic filing is all the returns go to the federal through their system, and then they parse out the state ones and they send us the Oregon one. So by validation, are you talking about signature validation?
How do you know that the return that my accountant sent for me is my return and not something else?
Chair Barnhart, there's a validation process where they require a pen or something of similar nature that for each return.
Some kind of a code?
Correct.
All right. Any other questions?
That's an interesting question, because my preparer files electronically, and I have no idea how they validate it. I never thought to ask. But I think maybe Representative Mayor Brewer might have a notion on that.
Yes, there's a, may I?
Please, yes.
There's a form that the taxpayer file signs giving the authority for the preparer to actually, one is the taxpayer may choose their own PIN number, or two, they may give authority to the preparer to assign a PIN number, and also allows them to transmit. There typically in every state is a form where the taxpayer themselves opts out from electronic filing and signs that form with their preparer, and then the preparer is granted an exception, even though they might be required under these rules or for any other state that has mandated electronic filing, even though they're required to file electronically, if the taxpayer opts out, then the preparer is not required to do it. And then it becomes a paper submission.
I see. So is that do we know if that's a federal allowance? Okay. So under this bill, if I understand it correctly, we have the same requirements that the federal government does. If the federal government allows an individual taxpayer to opt out, and the individual taxpayer does, then our rule would allow them to opt out as well. Have I understood that?
Yes. Chair Barnett, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Now, and this may be a question that Representative Eric Brewer can answer better than you can. How does a taxpayer figure out whether the return has been prepared correctly or not by the preparer if they don't receive a paper copy to review? How does that happen?
Okay, in the practical sense, that is something that each practitioner has to work out. It's not that the form is not printed. It's that it's not printed and filed.
Not submitted by
right.
printing. Yes.
And there are various ways that a tax preparer communicates the return with their client, and it can be electronically or through an actual hard copy that they can review. It's a matter of making sure, typically what happens is you meet with, again, I don't think this is going beyond this law, but typically the preparer will meet with the client, the client agree with the return, and they won't transmit until after the client has approved it.
Thank you. That's helpful. Anything else? Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this public hearing of House Bill 2071? Don't see anybody. With that, we'll close the public hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2072. And are you on that one, too? I think we're going to hear from Mazin first, and then it will be your turn. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, House Bill 2072, passing to you at this time the SMS and the testimony from the Department of Revenue. Before we go through that, let me mention that I put also in your packet in front of you this morning a page that has a table of the lottery profile player. This information was requested by Representative Vaughn and a few others. So this is this player profile is something that we had from the lottery that they do every year. We could probably go through some of that after the bill if you would like to, and we still have some time. However, the House Bill 2072, to get back, is a Department of Revenue bill. It primarily seeks to align the law and authorities between the two tobacco programs, mainly the cigarette and the other tobacco products. Try to use the same procedures and uniformity in enforcement, information sharing. The most thing that is new, introduction into the the law is primarily when you have in Section 2 and 3, and this is information sharing with different state agencies and the federal agencies that have to do with enforcement and collection of tobacco taxes. The most of the other bill is alignment of language and type of effective date type of thing at the end. However, the main thing that it wasn't necessarily at this point clear to me and asked the department to bring us the information is what is not being done today if this law is not introduced into the statutes. And additionally, if there was any revenue that comes because of the sharing and the new level of cooperation between the different federal and state agencies, but it seems like this is more of an efficiency type of change rather than an increased revenue collection type of change.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with your Department of Revenue. Just as a bit of context, ORS Chapter 323 has two series of statutes. ORS 323005 through 323482 deal with cigarette tax law, and 323500 through 323.645 deal with other tobacco products. And what we did in the last year or two was work with our attorneys to identify areas where there are differences in those programs that could be conformed to each other. What you have is House Bill 2072. As Mazin mentioned, you have new language in Sections 2 and Sections 3, and these are going into the other tobacco products series. Section 2, if you compare that new language to Section 9 of the bill, you'll see that it is very much the same as what currently exists in the cigarette tax program. There is a difference, however, if you look at Section 9, in that under the current law, we can share information relating to cigarette tax laws with other entities, that is federal and state governments outside of Oregon, that tax cigarettes. The issue that we're having is that we cannot share information with those that regulate cigarettes. And 10 years ago, the federal government restructured its programs for dealing with cigarette taxes, and it separated it into entities, one of which deals with tax and one of which deals with regulation. So we're able to share information with those that tax but not with those that regulate. So the point of Section 9 is to add regulation to the current law, and that would allow us to share information with federal and state governments that either tax or regulate tobacco. Cigarettes. Section 2, then, is adding that same language to the other tobacco products series, so they would be the same in allowing us to share information with entities that regulate or tax.
Representative Burke. Yes.
Thank you. Deborah, in this bifurcation of taxing and revenue and regulating, who is advantaged by this sharing, the regulator or us? In other words, is this information we find useful or is it information they find useful?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, it could be either or both. We did have a situation with Washington State where we had, they had asked us for information. And I don't know exactly how they're structured, but when we talked with our disclosure officers and our attorneys, that we couldn't share the information because they weren't a taxing authority. When we asked Washington for information to help us in our tax system, the natural response was, well, you didn't want to share with us. We're not going to share with you. So it can go both ways.
Please, yeah.
Yeah, but that's taxing. What's regulation? I mean, what? I guess what I'm looking for, and you don't have to answer this now, but at some point is a for instance here. What kinds of things would you be looking to get from regulators that would be helpful to us or regulators would want from us, and what's the public policy benefit of that? I, I'm lost in regulators and taxers and tobacco, and you know how tobacco is. It never is simple. And I guess I'm looking for what are we getting and what are we giving here. In sort of anecdotal would be fine. Just give me some examples. That would help me.
Just to clarify that particular point, are you in charge? Is the department in charge of the regulation of tobacco products other than cigarettes, in addition to taxing them?
Mr. Chair,
is it somebody else in Oregon?
My response would be no. That we are responsible for the tax administration. I would assume that the Department of Justice might have a regulatory function in assuring that only legal product is sold in the state, and perhaps Mazin has something to add to that as well. But
yes, Mazin.
Is it Tabasco? I mean the tobacco task force privy to this kind of enforcement, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, the tobacco task force that we did have a few years ago was made up of members of several different agencies, including Department of Justice and the Department of Revenue.
State Police
and others, I assume.
Right, right.
So I know that when we're talking about alcohol, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is responsible for making sure that store clerks and their stores and so forth don't sell to people who are below legal age. Who does that for tobacco?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's the state police.
The state police. Okay. So we don't really have anybody who's sort of focused on in that area. And if we had a rule that said certain kinds of candy tobacco products can't be sold in Oregon, that would probably also be the state police then, wouldn't it, that would enforce that?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it would be the Department of Revenue.
Yeah. So we have the same problem that other states do in the sense that the tax is one department, and regulation is, we're not sure who, but somebody else.
Mr. Chair, I think that's correct. I don't know whether there are the issues around the disclosure of information, whether those that regulate can disclose that information to other entities. I do know
right.
that the disclosure statutes restrict the tax information.
One presumes that the state police talk to the police departments in Washington and California and other places.
One presumes.
One presumes. Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that we're changing the term dealer to retailer, and I'm just wondering what the thought process is for why we're doing that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, that is one of the conformity changes between the two series. One series uses the term dealer. The other series uses the term retail dealers. So we're looking at one term that would be consistently used between both and settled on retailers. It's not intended to change any of the policy or any of the real definitional provisions.
Thank you.
That word has come to be derogatory, hasn't it? It recently.
Dealer.
It's synonymous with illegal salesperson. It's a person selling illegal products. And, of course, that's not what we're talking about here. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had two questions. One is as to Section 3, and I was just curious what prompted Section 3.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, thank you. That was the next issue in my paper, unless there are additional questions. Thank you. Section 3 is being added again to the other tobacco products series. You'll find almost identical language in the cigarette tax series. You don't have it in this bill, but it is in ORS 323.360. The issue that the attorneys identified for us is there is no requirement now in the other tobacco tax products, other tobacco products tax series that requires a consumer to file a report with us. It currently exists in cigarette tax law. It doesn't exist in this series, and yet they are liable for a tax, they are liable for penalties for failure to file a return or to pay the tax, but there's no explicit language in the statute that says they need to file a report. So that's what this is doing, is saying you need to file a report, and then the other statutes would actually have some significance.
Follow up here.
Can we hear from Mazin on that part, and then go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the President has been. This is probably one of the weaknesses that we have with the other tobacco tax. Remember the cigarettes.
Current law. Yeah.
The cigarettes, when they come, they have the stamps, and it's easy to track, and then you have the consumer, although ultimately responsible for paying the tax, it never actually gets to that point, because the consumer is always paying the tax through the retailer. The other tobacco, remember, the tax is in the wholesale price. However, the consumer never gets a wholesale price. So if the consumer is actually going to be paying the tax, which price should the consumer pay, which they never saw the wholesale price to start with? So there is some weakness in the way that we are requiring the consumer to be responsible for the tax on the other tobacco tax.
I think I know where we're going. Please, go ahead.
Well, I actually did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious how we would know that they haven't paid it.
That wasn't where I thought we were going, but go ahead. Let's proceed with that one.
I just want to know, does this come up in situations where we think people have been importing these things and the state police picked them up, or is it situations where we're trying to impose another level of tax? What is it that this will actually do for us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, it is not to impose another level of tax, but the tax liability exists in current law for a person who buys, consumes or uses the product that meets these thresholds, 100 cigars, or other products with a wholesale price of 50. If the tax has not been paid on those, the consumer is obligated to pay the tax. So that exists in current law. What we don't have is the requirement to file a report. So that's what this statute is dealing with. To your question about how would we know, that's an excellent question. And in my mind, this is very much like sales and use tax that exists in other states. And I'm sure you're familiar with this. Washington residents who come to Oregon and buy products that are taxable in their home state are supposed to file and pay a use tax. This is very much like that. The enforcement issues will be there for us. I would imagine that if we were, if we had found someone who bought cigarettes, for example, and didn't pay the tax, and we discovered that they had other tobacco products as well, then we would have an enforcement tool. But you're correct. In many cases, we aren't going to know.
Thank you.
I have the mirror image of that question, and that is, how is the consumer supposed to know when the tax has been paid or not? Now, there's some obvious examples, it seems to me. If the consumer buys candy chew tobacco on the Internet from somewhere off, one assumes that if they thought about the tax at all, they would know that it hadn't been paid. But what if they go to a retailer and, in fact, the tax had not been paid? How are they supposed to know that they're on the hook now for a report?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe they would know in the second case. In the first case, buying it from the Internet, my experience has been that's one of the marketing points of the Internet sites is to say you don't have to pay any tax on this and we'll sell it to you for less.
So
there's an awareness there.
So we're prosecuting some Internet salespeople for suggesting that Oregonians violate the tax law.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we are prosecuting them.
Well, let's get to work on that. Thank you. Anything else?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Representative Vance.
Were you talking about anything else as to Section 3 or anything else?
I'm sorry. Let's go ahead with the rest of the bill. You're quite correct.
Thank you very much. Unless there are other questions about Section 3, I can move on to Section 4, which I did already mention. It is a terminology change, but no change in definition. I did talk about Section 9 as well, which is in the cigarette tax statutes, expanding that to disclose to entities that regulate. Section 10 eliminates an obsolete provision related to jeopardy determinations that hasn't been relevant for quite a few years since the magistrate division of the tax court was put in place. Section 11, again, is changing the terminology. Section 15 is just clarifying that if we do a notice of jeopardy determination, the person who receives that notice is also the person required to pay the tax. And then Section 16 is the applicability provisions. And unless there are additional questions, Mr. Chair, that was my explanation.
All right. Thank you. I don't see anybody clamoring to ask a question. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard today on House Bill 2072?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2072. Manzin, you had something else that you wanted to raise before we go? And we have to be careful because we haven't got anything else on our agenda.
Well,
you wanted to make an announcement?
Mr. Chair, actually, I wanted to bring it to your to the attention of the committee, the player profile that the lottery does annually, and we ask them to share this year's thing with us. And if you see in their survey, they do a survey of 1,000 people or 1,000 respondents, and they build their type of reference and inference from that. And as you would see, they have a different demographics of male, female, age, and income. And you know, the most thing noticeable that you would see that about 28% only of players are people with an income of $75,000 or more, and it's about the same percentage, 29%. Are ones with college graduate or higher. And it seems that those percentages, not precisely that way, but very close, has been holding for this number of years that they've been tracking the player profile. So that's the thing that I just wanted to share with you.
And that was prompted from a question that you got here.
That's yeah. Right.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wan's question. Paul?
Mr. Chair, nature of the same thing. This is a follow-up to your informational hearing about the property tax. I did get an email from John Phillips while I was sitting over there, and John was listening in about the question on what proportion of the value of property is assessed directly by DOR. So that would be for forest land, utility, and industrial land. It's about 10.5% of total value.
Ah, so the counties handle 90%.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Well, just a quick comment on the lottery profile. I will tell you, I'm a bit surprised how close the demographics of the players track with the total sample. I would have expected it to be slightly different than that, and this is useful information for me. Thank you.
And it has been holding
pretty steadily that way.
Not precisely, but very close.
Well, there's some variations because the sample's different, too. I mean, it's a pretty good-sized sample, though. This is helpful. I'm assuming that the variance is probably, what, about 5%, something like that, where the sample sample size this large. Anything else this morning? Okay, with that, see you tomorrow. Committee is adjourned.